not by way of application, but just if we look also at Moses and Joshua, Joshua dealt with the unbelief of the people. That's what the scripture said in 1 Corinthians 10. But Joshua dealt with the fleshly activity of the people. Moses dealt with the unbelief of the people, and Joshua dealt with their fleshly activities. But I want to say something else about, not to take anything from Moses, but there's an incident that might give us light why Moses did not proceed. Although, every instruction that was given to Moses, you read Exodus 12, and he tells him who has the right to eat from the Passover, and one of the subject was, those have to be, if the stranger or foreigner, they need to be circumcised. But I think Moses in his life tasted something that brought him a lot of conflict when he circumcised his own son. And there was a tremendous measure of resistance by his own wife, that she called him, "Thou art indeed a bloody man." I mean, he is doing something out of exercise that traced to him a tremendous measure of conflict that started within the house. And I wonder if this was something that restrained Moses in some measure, because after all, he was the meekest man on earth, and the confrontation that we read of always belonged to Joshua. And that's why I really believe the most individual that got the promise, "I will not forsake you, nor leave you, nor fail you," it was really Joshua, more than any other person. Because Joshua had to confront a lot of issues that were fleshly. And you know what? God is supporting him. He doesn't want him to think of when he was a young man, when they almost got stoned. Listen, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be resistance, but I will never leave you, nor forsake you. And these three locations of promises that are given to Joshua, they are very essential to him to be able to deal with all what the flesh is capable of doing.
So just to be specific about what we've been saying about this circumcision, the verse in Colossians chapter 2 is very clear to say that circumcision, for the Christian, it represents putting away the flesh, or putting away the sins of the flesh. And there's also a reference in Philippians chapter 3. We are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit and have joy, and we have no confidence in the flesh. And so this activity, this represents to us this idea of having no confidence in the flesh. And we said it already in the very first time we met Joshua this morning, is the very first thing he had to deal with. And it's been saying he seems to have this repeated need, or he is put in repeatedly in the same position of being reminded himself, indicating to the people, the flesh is still a problem. The flesh is still a problem. And in the battle, we didn't touch on it too explicitly, but it said the battle with Amalek in Exodus 17, the Lord is going to have war with Amalek to every generation. And we might say every generation has to learn that anew. We might also say that every stage that we are at, we have to learn that anew. There's the flesh of middle age, and there's the flesh of old age. It's all the same bad flesh, but it's the ongoing battle. And so before there's going to be this victory, this is why this is very key, that after they've crossed through the Jordan, before they can have any battles that they will be victorious in, there must be circumcision. And also it says, verse 9, the Lord makes another additional comment about this. It's rolling away the reproach of Egypt. Everybody around us makes decisions based on their flesh. That's the normal way we make decisions when we're natural people. That's all we have. We assess things, we figure out what the best advantage is for us, and we go ahead and do it. It's the reproach of Egypt to have confidence in the flesh, however, for a believer. And so this was Gilgal. This was rolling. Roll it away. That's what really needs to be rolled away for the Christian, is in this, at least in this application, this illustration. The name of that place is Gilgal. It was rolled away, the reproach of Egypt. But there's more to come. This is the one lesson. But there's also the food. We just mentioned that earlier. I'm just going to touch on that and move us into that passage. They also had to eat something, and the manna ceased in verse 12. They had been depending on the manna all these years. Every morning, there it was, faithfully. Man eating angels' food, the food of service, was faithfully provided in the wilderness. But now they're in the land, and so they don't need wilderness food anymore. They need the food that is suitable for the promised land. And so they eat, the King James says, the old corn of the land. I'd just like to comment on that phrase. It sounds maybe a little bit unappealing. Let's go have some old corn. But it doesn't mean old like it's old and moldy. It means that it was already harvested. It's the stored up grain. It's not even just corn on the cob corn. It's the corn used in the meaning of grain. The stored up grain of the land. It's already been harvested. It has grown up above the ground the way grain does. It's resurrection food, if you might say it that way. It's up above the earth. It's not the melons and the leeks and the garlics that grow on the ground that they used to eat in Egypt. It's this grain that's above the ground. And so it's resurrection food, remembering Christ not even as the manna on the ground, which we also need him as that in our wilderness life, but in the land to appreciate those heavenly blessings. We set our minds on things that are above, where Christ is, in Colossians 3. And so their food is changing. There was one day of overlap. The day after they ate the stored up grain, that's the day, next day, the manna ceased. But their food is changing. And it was well prepared, preserved for them. It was preserved food, already harvested. The work was done, and now they can enjoy this grain.
So who is the harvester? I think it's important to focus on that, because it is the work of God himself in preparing what was necessary for them to take in the supply that will enable them to enter upon conflict in the land. It's the richness of divine supply on his gracious part. And I think you might parallel it to the disciples at the end of John when they came back from catching nothing. He had the fire lit and he had the breakfast there for them. Nothing that they had provided. Here it is, the same characteristical feature of the richness of divine provision for them in him storing it up so that as they enter upon the land, there is the blessedness that there is for their enjoyment.